Journalism, writ large. That's about all we can say about it. Right now, though, we face, I think, that the environmental issues before us are far more important than a bogus sham election. Just go ahead and vote for whoever is not a Republican. It doesn't matter. It makes no difference whatsoever. But what does make a difference right now and into the foreseeable future is the fact that we are destroying our planet. We are rapidly creating the conditions of extinction. This has been Air Cascadia for Monday, August 3rd, 2015. Kate Welch engineered the show for us today. Thanks, Kate. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts. Know your rights. Take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
Tune in to the podcast Probable Cause This on the KBOO website. KBOO.FM/probable cause. On this podcast, I look at the top stories on the lack of accountability for police and public officials in Oregon and across the country. That's KBOO.FM/probable cause for a weekly roundup of stories on holding our public officials accountable to we the people.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. In recent years, scientific perceptions of wildfires have changed. Once viewed as an anathema to healthy forests, now fire is recognized as a vital component of forest health. Yet severe fires are still feared by most forest managers, who do their best to prevent them. This morning, we talk with forest ecologist Dominic Della Sala, who is co-author of The Ecological Importance of Mixed Severity Fires, Nature's Phoenix, which argues that mixed severity fires, ones that produce low to high severity effects in a single fire complex, also play an important role in producing remarkably rich and diverse wildlife habitat and are not ecological disasters as claimed. Dominic is president and chief scientist of the Geo Institute in Ashland. Dominic, welcome back to Locus Focus.
Thanks for having me on again, Barbara, in this smoky Rogue Valley day down here in Southern Oregon.
So how are the fires doing down here? Because up here, we're sort of in between fires, but what's happening down south?
Oh, it's quite smoky here, and we've got a number of fire complexes that are burning to the north and the south, which is what you would expect in a drought season, which is what a lot of the West is getting right now, because fires follow droughts.
So are you getting a lot of the smoke from the Rocky Fire in northwestern California?
Yeah, that's one of the complexes. We also have some just south of Roseburg, too, and one just outside of Josephine County that's been burning since early July.
Well, I checked the news this morning before I left, and I was on the CNN webpage, which I don't get to very often, and they had an article about the Rocky Fire, and the headline, or the little tag before the headline was extreme weather. So I wonder, do you see that there's a connection between the what we've been seeing is extreme weather with the severe droughts, particularly in California, but even up here in northern Oregon, we're certainly experiencing a drought. Do you see a connection between that and the intensity of the wildfire season this year?
Absolutely. I mean, just about everywhere you go in the country these days is weird weather events happening. And because we've been on a book tour with this new book release, and I was in D.C. last week, and they were having record temperatures down in Florida, record rainfall. And in the West, much of it is in, you know, a very severe drought. And when you have very dry conditions and hot temperatures, which is what we've been getting in Southern Oregon and Northern California, then that is the recipe for large fires. And large fires tend to burn under extreme weather conditions, which is what the norm is, and it might be the new norm with climate change now.
Well, we'll talk a little bit more about that later. I'm sort of reminiscing with myself about some of the past really big fires and remembering them also being the intensely hot, dry summers. And I think back to 2002 when the Biscuit Fire burned for most of the summer down your way. And that was an incredibly hot summer, even up here in Portland. So are we seeing enough of a parallel between like the really hot years, hot, dry years, and the fires to be able to make a very clear correlation that climate change induced weather, which is creating hotter, drier conditions in a lot of places in the West, is also responsible for these, for more fires and perhaps more intense fires?
I think so. It's certainly consistent with the trend in fire behavior, if you will, over the last several decades. Fire has been increasing in acres burned in many places in the West, and that appears to be a climate signal. Now, the interesting thing about this is that even with the recent increase in acres burned, there hasn't been an increase in the severity of fires, only the acres burned. And we're still in a significant deficit compared to what early European settlers and Native American people once experienced here in the late 1800s. So they were getting even more smoke and more fire than what we are getting today, but there's been a recent increase that appears to be related to a climate signal.
But how do you explain that the fire severity hasn't increased along with the amount of acreage that's burning?
That's really interesting. We haven't quite figured out that mechanism yet, but it just, when you compare the severity of historical fires compared to today, about 20% or so of these large burns would burn in high severity where most of the trees were killed, and we're seeing very similar percentages today, especially in places that are still relatively wild, like wilderness areas and national parks. Their fire severities are burning very similar to what European explorers and Native Americans witnessed back in the late 1800s.
Well, you say that we're in a fire deficit. So what does that mean? Are you sort of suggesting that perhaps we need to have some of these severe fires and we need to have more fires than we were having up until the last two or three decades?
Well, I think we're going to get it no matter what our wishes are or our best intents to suppress fire, just because these large burns will occur during extreme weather events, and the extremes are what we're likely to get under a changing climate. So I think that deficit's going to close on its own accord. And from an ecological standpoint, that's not a bad thing, because there are a lot of fire-dependent ecosystems and species that really need those burns, even the severe ones. It's just a real pain in dealing with the smoke and with the hazards, with people now living in, you know, fire sheds, we call them. And there are ways that we can coexist with an increase in fire, but, you know, we're just not going to log or suppress our way out of this, as these fires are following the change in global climate that's happening all over the planet.
Well, I'm thinking back to a couple summers ago. I was in Missoula, Montana, and I was there for the pine pollen season and discovered I had a horrible allergy to pine pollen and was miserable the whole time I was there. And so when I was leaving, I was saying to my friends, well, I think I should come back later in the summer after the pine pollen's gone. And they said, oh, that's when the smoke happens. And that was kind of, I was sort of seeing that this is life in western Montana, that you have different seasons, and there's the pine pollen season, there's the smoke season, and then you have the snow season. And this was 2 years ago, so it's certainly in the regime, the fire regime that we're talking about now. But is that something that you would think of as should be, it was traditionally like what the way forests burned in Montana through like way, way back, that it's a normal thing to just expect that from July through September that you're going to smell smoke in Missoula?
I think so, and I think we're going to get more of it, unfortunately, because we're changing the atmosphere on this planet, and fires are going to follow these extreme weather events. Extremes are going to become the new norm. And so we've really got to solve for climate change if we're going to solve for the effects of climate change. And, you know, you mentioned, you know, let's just move around and get out of the pollen season until, you know, the pollen's gone. And the same thing with the fire season. People can just go somewhere else and get out of the smoke. But, you know, no matter where you go in the States these days, there's weird weather going on. And so, you know, if you go to Florida, you're going to be getting hit with intense rain and hurricane season. And, you know, you can move around, but you can't escape the effects of climate change. And we really got to resolve that.
Yeah, actually, I think that's one of the things that's hitting a lot of people I talk to this summer, especially farmers. But, I mean, this has been, I've been trying to remember if I've ever lived through a hotter summer in Oregon. I've been here for a long time than this summer, and I keep thinking, well, no, the summer of 2002 when the Biscuit Fire burned, it was pretty hot that summer too. But there's something in the air this summer that I feel a lot of people are feeling, that there's this palpable change, and that a lot of people are afraid that those periodic nice cool summers that we would have here in Portland are a thing of the past, and that sufficient rainfall and snowpack that keeps us in water throughout the year, that's a thing of the past. Should we be that concerned that maybe we've turned a corner and that what we recollect and what we think of as familiar is no longer available to us?
Yeah, I think there is a growing concern about the alarming changes in weather patterns that we're seeing across the states these days. And yeah, it could flip, and it could flip pretty quickly to a new state of climate, but there's still time, I think, to minimize the damages that we're going to see if we don't act soon, to human health, to all kinds of losses of environmental issues that we need, like clean water and clean air. We're dealing with the smoke down here in Oregon. There's so many other impacts that we're seeing from climate change. If you're in Alaska, you've got flooding. If you're on the coast, you've got sea level rise. You've got more intense storms in the southeast. So we're seeing the beginning changes here, and they're already quite extreme. So if we're going to stop this, we need to do it really soon. Otherwise, it's going to be locked in.
Well, I want to get back to the one of the issues that you're very familiar with, which is the beneficial effects of fire and why we need fire. And we talked a little earlier about the idea that there's a fire deficit that we are starting to fill in now. But there's when we have fires like we're having this summer, and actually this summer doesn't seem to me quite as extreme as some of the other summers when there's been even bigger fires in the last 10 years or 15 years. But there's concern, and we hear in the media a lot, that this is causing more carbon dioxide emissions to the atmosphere and will exacerbate climate change. And that's a reason to try to prevent these fires. So what's your thought? Are forest fires actually a greenhouse gas driver, like automobile emissions and coal fire plant emissions and things like that?
Well, you know, first of all, we cannot prevent large fires. Large fires are going to happen in drought and extreme weather conditions, no matter what we do to try to suppress them, no matter what we do to try to thin our way or log our way out of this. If the climate is changing, we're going to get big fires and emissions. Now, those emissions are not currently a major source of carbon dioxide pollution to the atmosphere. If you look at the contributing factors to global warming around the planet, the two biggest factors are the burning of fossil fuels and deforestation. Deforestation contributes to more greenhouse gas pollution than the entire global transportation network. And so the forest fires are contributing, but they're way down the list of contributing factors at this point. Now, that could change as we start to see more fire burning from extreme weather events, but right now, it's way down the list of priorities.
Well, some people consider forest fires to be a form of deforestation. Would you agree or disagree with that?
Absolutely not. And so what we found in this book, and we worked on this with 27 scientists around the globe that had been studying the incredible and remarkable rejuvenation that happens in a forest after a burn. It truly is nature's phoenix. It comes back quite well, and there are some species that absolutely require even the most severe burn patches. We've got all kinds of woodpeckers and bluebirds and morel mushrooms, and you know, we just see a lot of diversity in these post-burn landscapes, and that diversity rivals what we see in the much more heralded old-growth forests.
Well, I want to sort of share an experience that I had last month. I was hiking through my favorite part of Mount Hood, the Vista Ridge Trail on the north face of Mount Hood, and it's a place that I've been going to for many decades. And when the fire, the big Dollar Lake fire, burned there 4 years ago, it was both, I felt a certain kind of heartbreak, which I think people experience when their favorite place in the world burns. At the same time, I was fascinated, and having talked with you a whole lot, I knew that this was probably a good thing for the mountain. But when I hiked through it last month, I had this kind of interesting mixed experience. On the one hand, there's a huge amount of life returning, and there are these little fir shoots growing all over, and some of them are actually a couple feet tall now. And I think there were also some spruce coming up, and of course the understory, the huckleberry and all the flowers, the avalanche lilies were just phenomenal. The bear grass was incredible. So there was all this life there, but there's also these, and then those incredible, now they're silver, like last time I was through there, there was the reddish dead trees with the bark peeling off, which is really quite an interesting sight. So there's an aesthetic there that you can appreciate. But I found this time, because we were going on a day when it was close to 90 degrees and we were hiking up the rather steep climb through the burn, that there was something very exhausting and wearying about going through this area where the sections where the high intensity fire happened, and there's nothing on the ground still. It's just basically the mineral traces and the soil is completely burned away. And how do we balance this kind of mix of emotions between appreciating the need for fire, but having to go through this kind of mourning of losing our favorite places?
Yeah, I think that's a really important point. And I, you know, now have two books under my belt. The first one I did was on rainforests of the world. And so when we look at a forest, we see this verdant, beautiful oasis of life. And we tend to associate that with very green forest. And so we've got that perception in our mind that if it's a green forest, it's a healthy forest. And so when I took on the second project and worked on this book on the aftermath of forest fires, we saw something very similar, but we had to use a different set of, you know, glasses, if you will, to look through the forests that were coming back quite well on their own. They weren't these green, verdant forests right away. So time since fire really makes a difference. If you go in right after the burn, it looks like a disaster. But if you come in at 1 year, 3 year, 5 year, 10 year intervals, it really is a living kaleidoscope of plants and wildlife that are just remarkable and as diverse as what I would see in a verdant old-growth forest.
Well, I think it's interesting to me. I started visiting the Biscuit Fire about a year and a half after the burn, and so I got to watch a couple different stages of its return between 2004 and 2006. But it was an area that I wasn't that familiar with. I hadn't spent any time in that area before it burned. And the other issue with the Brisket Fire, which we'll get to momentarily, was that there was a big controversy about logging it there because a lot of it happened in unprotected areas. The Dollar Lake Fire, on the other hand, burned entirely within a wilderness area. So nobody's going in and mucking it up. There's been no post-fire logging. There's going to be no tree planting. Everything, they did cut a few down logs or trees across the path, and this, you get a couple areas where you can see that, I guess there were chainsaws used in that area, or maybe they did it all with axes, I'm not sure. But it really is like a living laboratory of watching a fire return, as opposed to the Biscuit, which was basically a battle zone for 4 years. But there's a sense, a difference, I think, when you know a landscape and you're watching it return. And I, the last time when I was up there this summer on the Vista Ridge Trail, I was thinking about how I don't know that this forest is going to grow back to what I remember in my own lifetime. And these are kinds of hard things to balance when you're thinking about the importance of fire at the same time when you're thinking about something that you really love that has seemed to have disappeared.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. I mean, I had the same experience when I was hiking the Babyfoot Trailhead over in the Biscuit Burn. I mean, before the fire, it was an old-growth forest, botanically rich in rare plants. And when the fire came through, it burned in high intensity and wiped out all the understory plants, killed the big trees. And, you know, it was visually a crushing blow. But, you know, I've gone back to that place now several times in 5 and 10 years and even longer after the Biscuit, and it's remarkable. There's sounds of woodpeckers, there's bluebirds nesting in that forest now, there's an incredibly diverse understory, the conifers are coming back, there's all kinds of rare plants coming in. So you just have to be patient with nature. It's quite resilient if we let her come back without messing it up with logging and tree planting after a fire, which does a lot of damage to the rejuvenating qualities of that forest after a burn.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning about forest fire. We are in fire season now, and my guest is Dominic Della Sala, who's co-author of a new book called The Ecological Importance of Mixed Severity Fires, Nature's Phoenix. So let's talk a little bit more about that subtitle of your book, Nature's Phoenix. What does that mean?
Well, you know, it came from a hike that I did with my 10-year-old daughter. We were hiking one day up to a burn area out on Grizzly Peak, just outside of Ashland, Oregon, where I live. And the fire had burned on the peak about 10 years earlier. And we're hiking through this, and my daughter says, "Wow, there's so many dragonflies and butterflies and birds in this place. It's just remarkable. It's beautiful." And right then, you know, I thought, you know, if my 10-year-old could get it, then I've got to do a book on this. I've got to get it out to decision makers. I've got to show people that these places are not disasters. They come back quite well on their own if we let them. And so I thought about what kind of symbol can we use to really convey a different kind of visual image of these places after a burn. And, you know, we've got Smokey the Bear that was very successful in getting people to responsibly manage their campsites. So we needed something other than Smokey. So the image that came to me was a phoenix, because literally that's what happens in these forests after a fire. The soon after the burn, you have seedlings coming right up out of the ashes, right from the parents that were killed by the fire. So you've got the next progeny, if you will, of a forest that's beginning right before your eyes. Usually that happens in the spring, right after the fall burn. And so that's the way we wanted to portray it, and using symbols and a different kind of imagery that people can relate to. And everybody knows the myth of the phoenix, which rises out of the ashes and is reborn and rejuvenated after it dies. And that's essentially what happens to a forest after it burns.
Well, I think there's definitely been a shift in consciousness around fire, because when I talked to people about the fact that I was going on this hike, everybody who is a nature enthusiast and hiker said to me, the wildflowers must have been amazing. And they were the most incredible wildflower display I've ever seen. And some of it had to do with, I'm generally not up on the north face of Mount Hood at the end of June. Usually I would be doing this hike at the end of August and past the wildflowers. Usually there's snow everywhere, and this year there's no snow on the mountain. So there's kind of, there was the good and the bad, but I could really see both through the burn, and then it seemed to affect even the areas in the mosaic where it was less severely burned or not burned at all, that everywhere there was a burst of life that I've never seen to this extent in this area.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think, you know, this saying is, The variety is the spice of life, and that's certainly the case with these burns. They don't burn in one homogenous, continuous kind of kill zone, so you get a lot of variability. If you were flying over that wilderness burn, you would be looking at a kaleidoscope of different burn severities, and that makes ecologists really excitable, because when you have that kind of variability at the landscape level, you've got habitat for old growth species in the lightly burned portions of the fire, you've got habitat for woodpeckers in the severely burned portion of the fire, and everything in between will benefit from the new habitat created by those fire patches.
Actually, what I found really interesting, another place I like to go hiking is about a couple miles west of the Vista Ridge Trail. And it's an area I hike up to near McNeil Point where that was like the boundary where you couldn't go past in 2011 after the Dollar Lake fire. But I've been seeing every time I go up to McNeil Point signs of its adjacentness to this extreme burn that happened just a couple miles away. I think we talked about this last time we talked. I saw a black-backed woodpecker there a couple years ago right after the fire and was rather surprised. I'd never seen that woodpecker in the woods, and it wasn't in the burn, but it was maybe about 3 miles away from the burn. And when I was up there a few weeks ago, there were an incredible number of hummingbirds, and I've never seen that many hummingbirds up there. So I wonder if there's also besides having the severe burned areas bringing back a lot variety of wildlife, if it affects areas that are a few miles away from the burn.
Absolutely. And you know, I'm glad you mentioned the black-backed woodpecker, because this is a species that was born out of fire, literally. It's a great example of nature's phoenix, because you know, you look at the species itself, the bird has a black back, and it blends in with the charred tree trunks that it's foraging on. So this is a species that follows the flames, if you will. As soon as the fire is out, they go in to the burned areas and start feeding on the trees by drilling into the bark, eating insect larvae, nesting in the trees, and they only stay in those burnt forests for 4 or 5 years, and then they move on to the next burned forest. And it's one of the species that we're very concerned about. It's declining in many parts of its range, mainly because of those burnt forests almost always get logged after the fire. And so it's, you know, losing habitat, and it's an example of a species that not only benefits from those burned areas, but requires it in order for it to be, you know, remain viable throughout its range.
Well, another more famous species in this region, the spotted owl, also seems to be affected by fire, and it's associated with old growth forests and verdant green forests that you're describing, but what's the spotted owl's relationship as well to burnt forests?
I think we've had some surprises with the spotted owl, especially in the southern part of its range. When you get down here into southern Oregon, northern California, and then you get down even further south into the Sierra where the California spotted owl exists, you know, this bird, it seems to be benefiting from forest fires that burn in a mosaic pattern. And it's kind of the bed and breakfast effect, if you will. So if there are unburned or lightly burned or even moderately burned patches in a large fire complex, that will provide the nesting habitat for spotted owls. And then the intensely burned areas then are colonized by small mammals that the owl is feeding on. So it seems to have evolved to coexist with these large fire complexes. And it's unfortunately that federal agencies are overblowing at this point the impact of fire on the owl, thinking that it's, you know, it's not good for the owl, when in fact the owl may be quite adaptable to these large fire complexes if they're not followed by post-fire logging.
Well, let's talk a little bit about two big fires down your way that have had very controversial post-fire logging regimens, the Biscuit Fire and the Rim Fire, which burned around the, inside and outside of Yosemite Park just a few years ago. Let's talk a little bit about first what the impact those fires had on the landscape and then the controversy around how the areas were managed after the fire.
Right. So, you know, when we look at the acres and the severity of those big burns, whether it's the Biscuit or the Rim Fire, they burned very similar to what we have seen in the historical accounts. So in both of those situations, about 20% of the large burn area was in high severity, and those patches were small and large and everything in between. and the rest of the burn was in low to moderate severity. And so we determine severity by the percentage of trees that are killed by a fire. So you get these high severity patches where 75 to 100% of the trees are killed. And then you get on the other end of the spectrum, the low severity, where hardly any of the trees are killed and the understory is affected and everything in between. So you get that kind of mosaic pattern as we've been talking about. It's very beneficial to a broad suite of wildlife species on both ends of the spectrum. You've got blackback woodpeckers needing the severe burns, spotted owls using everything in between, and other species not wanting fire in their habitat. So that's a very beneficial fire in both of those situations. Now, what has happened is that as we are seeing bigger fires in places, we're seeing bigger and bolder post-fire logging. And we're seeing policy changes that are being attempted by the House and the Senate to override environmental laws to go into these areas to salvage log them, and under the guise that we need to lower fuels, we need to restore the forest, and the only way to do that is to replant and salvage log. Now, what we're seeing when that happens is we destroy the ability of the forest to come back because the logging machinery compacts the soils. It drags the logs up slope, crushing the conifer seedlings that are coming back, and it leaves a lot of the logging slash behind. So the next fire that comes through that area will burn uncharacteristically intense and set back forest rejuvenation even further. So we've kind of entered this dangerous feedback loop where the more we log, the more we set these forests up for uncharacteristic burns that then go with salvage logging to set them up for the next big fire. So at least part of what we're seeing in terms of how these fires are increasing in size is the way the landscape has been managed in the last, 50 or 60 years.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dominic Della Sala, who's co-author of The Ecological Importance of Mixed Severity Fires, Nature's Phoenix, and we're talking about the importance of appreciating and working with high-severity fires in our national forests as opposed to trying to suppress them or, after the effect, kind of re-engineer the landscape. I'm thinking about how you've talked about needing to reshape our language around fire, and that seems to be a real challenging thing. That in the fire season, for instance, the article I was reading about the Rocky Fire going on in northwestern California, there's still the talk about catastrophic fire and disaster and catastrophe and cataclysm and other things that are used. So how do you see that we need to reshape our language so we can better appreciate the important role that fire plays?
Yeah, I think, you know, catastrophic is a human term, and it certainly applies to a fire that's destroying homes or lives. That is a catastrophe, no doubt. But from an ecological standpoint, we need to purge that language when we describe forest fires. And I've been working very closely with a lot of media folks and also with even the conservation community that's using language such as the fire consumed the forest, or the fire resulted in a moonscape or disaster. And that is as far from the truth as possible. We know the opposite is happening. And so what we're saying is, at least from an ecological standpoint, maybe the new language that we need is the fire affected 100,000 acres, or the fire resulted in a mixed mosaic of burn intensities, or let's celebrate this fire ecologically that's burning through a wilderness. It's not a disaster. It's just part of the cycle of life that happens in these forests that they go through over hundreds of years.
So an importance that hikers need to kind of rethink burned areas. I was reading William Sullivan's latest version of his hiking book to North Grabbing through Vista Ridge Trail where the burn happened. And he talks about there's a fork in the trail where you can go on this old trail that was the old Vista Ridge Trail and go through a verdant forest. But for those of you who are really brave, and energy, you know, have a lot of energy and in great shape. You can go through this desperate area of the burn, basically. And I tend to think his writing's a little overblown when he talks about all these grueling hikes and things. He uses grueling a lot. But I was a little disturbed that he set it up that it would be a really negative experience going through the burn. He does say that it's worth it for watching the forest grow back and you get some great views up ahead. But basically he's saying you get through the burn and then you get up the timberline and didn't burn there and you'll be really happy you're there. So I'm remembering a friend one time who was describing going for, she was backpacking and wound up camping in a burned area and how it was really a distressing experience for her and really depressing to be there. But I understand that on a certain level. I was thinking again about my hike on the Vista Ridge Trail this summer and the fact that when we did it in extreme heat, it was intensified. And I think the ways that we have a negative reaction to burned landscapes is exacerbated when you're looking for relief from the sun and there is none. And then I was remembering the first time I went hiking on a lava flow and how fascinating that was. Though I found, as with the burn, like going through the first mile is not so bad, but the second mile can start to become a little bit more tiring and difficult to deal with. And maybe we have to kind of learn how we experience these parts of forests, whether it's lava flows or burns, and find ways that we can appreciate them without also kind of risking our own safety and health.
Yeah, absolutely. And I show this picture in my talks with half of the photo is a verdant, green, beautiful forest, and half of it is a blackened forest, and there's almost a line right down the middle where this burn went through and didn't affect the other side of the forest. And I ask the audience, which is more important, the green forest or the blackened forest? And, you know, just about everybody raises their hand, the green forest. But, you know, the reality is, from an ecological standpoint, both images are important. Both serve a function and a purpose in nature, and both are linked. So what happens to that burnt forest will determine whether or not it becomes a green forest over the next decade or century. And so if we don't learn to appreciate both, then we will destroy one thinking that we're actually restoring it, and that will affect the forest and the whole rejuvenation process for decades to centuries. So somehow we've got to cut through our biases and our perceptions and actually look at these forests the way nature does, that this is just part of the cycle of life and death in a forest.
Well, how can we use the lessons of wilderness areas that burn like in the dog, like fire, and start to apply them to areas that are not protected like Biscuit or the Rim Fire? Though the Rim Fire, part of it was burning, I'm assuming, in protected landscapes. Some of it burned within Yosemite National Park. So in the Rim Fire, was there a difference in how it was managed depending on whether it was national forest land or the parkland?
Yeah, there was, and it's interesting. We're finishing up a study now that's looking at the difference in the way the fire burned in the national park, the Yosemite National Park, and wilderness areas in the surroundings versus in heavily logged areas, and we are seeing differences. And so what we're seeing in the heavily logged landscape is when the fire went through those burn patches or went through those clear cuts that were densely stocked with trees and plantations, it blew up. And when the fire burned in the wilderness and in the national park, it burned in a mixed mosaic pattern, which is what we've seen historically and what we see in a lot of these fires that are burning in wild places. So the fire is doing exactly what nature intended it to do in wild places, and it's burning up uncharacteristically through plantations and more severe patterns that we've influenced by the way we manage that landscape.
Actually, I was reading an article online yesterday about somebody, another lover of the Vista Ridge Trail, who was describing going up there the year after the fire. And he used catastrophic and all the words you don't want him to use, but he also appreciated the important role the fire played in the landscape and in the forest. And one of the things he commented about, which is something I also noticed, that the Vista Ridge Trail has been returned to its name because for many years there was so much growth of fir that you really couldn't see much of the vistas that you should be seeing along the trail, which I remember from actually mid-70s, the first time I was up there, that now that those younger noble fir trees are snags, you can see these incredible vistas, and you see all the way to eastern Oregon. So maybe these are ways that we can start to appreciate that on an aesthetic level and on a kind of emotional level, we can find ways to live with this fire regime and to find ways to appreciate its importance.
Yeah, I think so. I think, you know, just thinking back at some of the way John Muir used to communicate, you know, you got to think like a mountain. So in this case, you know, you got to think like a blackback woodpecker or a western bluebird. From their vantage point, the fire was rejuvenating. It wasn't a disaster. I mean, the green forest maybe was the disaster. And the burnt forest is, you know, nirvana for those species. So we got to kind of put our lens aside of looking only at beauty as a verdant green forest and actually appreciate that there's a connection between a burned forest and a green forest, and they're inseparable. And what we do to that burned forest affects whether or not it will become a green forest over time. And it has intrinsic value because it's so important for all those fire-dependent web of life species that need that fire to rejuvenate.
Well, it makes me kind of sad when I think about the Biscuit Fire, that if Clinton's roadless rule had been enacted a little earlier than it was in his administration and hadn't been upheld or thrown out by Bush and then in court litigated for the next 2 years, that probably that logging wouldn't have happened in the Biscuit. And I'm wondering if you think about that and if that's a lesson about how to get some of these areas more protection so that there'll be more Dahlia Lake fire regrowths as opposed to Biscuit and Rim regrowths.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, wilderness, national parks, roadless areas, protected landscapes are our best hope for getting everything that is important from nature in a beneficial way and sustainable way. And, you know, you think of these places not only as areas where fire can burn the way nature intended, but they're giving us recreational values, spiritual, you know, all kinds of you know, values that we get from clean water and clean air that we don't get in the heavily impacted landscape and that we're seeing a lot less of as the, you know, planet becomes intensely developed and overpopulated. So we need these areas and we need to stay connected to them whether they're burned or unburned. They just need to be protected just for their own sake and because of what we get from them and all the values that we derive.
Well, Dominic, it's always good talking with you. I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Yeah, you bet. Thanks for having me on your show
again. And I hope that the air doesn't get too smoky down there for you.
Okay, we'll do.
Okay. We've been talking with Dominic Della Sala, co-editor of The Ecological Importance of Mixed Severity Fires, Nature's Phoenix. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. I'll be taking a break for the next 5 weeks to put the final touches on the film I've been working with Elaine Velasquez for the past 4 years about food justice called Gaining Ground. It's going to be premiering at the end of September. I'll be back the week after Labor Day to jump headfirst into the fall pledge drive. Meanwhile, my engineer is Kate Welch. I want to thank her for, she's been a great engineer all these months, and I'm looking forward to seeing her again when I get back. Before we go out, I just want to make mention that this was an historic week. Since last week when we did the show about the Fennica icebreaker coming to Portland, we got to witness some history-making experiences, particularly the Sierra, the Greenpeace climbers rappelling off the St. John's Bridge and dangling there for 40 hours, I believe. So we're going to go out with some music I recorded at the rally the evening right after the Fennica broke through the blockade and the climbers came down and the kayaktivists came out of the water. And this is a song by Anna Fritz called Turn the Boats Around. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening.
Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground and turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground and turn the ships around. Keep it going. Cascadia is a place of great power. We stand at the mouth of the river, rooted to the land and its people, we turn the ships around. Cascadia is a place of great power. We stand at the mouth of the river, rooted to the land and its people, we turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground, turn the ships around. We are a people. We are a people awakening. We are a people reclaiming. We are a people demanding, turn the ships around. We are a people awakening. We are a people reclaiming. We are a people demanding, turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground and turn the ships around.
And it is coming up on 11 a.m. You are tuned to KBOO in Portland. And we will be hearing Health Watch with host Dr. David Naiman. He speaks with John Lifu today, an expert on the needs of cancer patients, about his book, After You Hear It's Cancer, A Guide to Navigating the Difficult Journey Ahead. At 11:30, stay tuned for Madness Radio with host Will Hall. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a KBOO member, you can become one. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the ever-present nuclear threat, Thursday, August 6th, at the Japanese American Historical Plaza at Waterfront Park in Portland. 70 years after Hiroshima and Nagasaki will feature speakers and performers, including Portland Taiko, and will provide opportunities for attendees to get involved in efforts to abolish nuclear weapons.